Today, I am very happy to be talking with Anne Murdoch. I have known Anne for many years. She is my sister-in-law, and I am truly happy to have her as a family member. She is funny, inspiring, and one of the most courageous persons I know. Anne retired from the Army at the rank of Lieutenant Colonel. She served overseas in Korea and Afghanistan. She holds a civilian position in the federal government and is a sought-after speaker, author, and activist. She is also currently the national president of the Transgender American Veterans Association. In addition to her professional accomplishments, Anne enjoys hiking, bicycling, and sailing. So Anne, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you so much. And we actually went to high school together, of course.
That's right.
even though we didn't know each other back then.
I know. It is cool. I'm just kind of get our interview started. I saw your post about the were you a disc jockey for the high school radio station? What was your participation?
Home and Fosmer High School had a radio program. They had a 10-watt radio station, and then while I was a student there, it increased to 1,500 watts, and it was all student-ran. So the students were the general director, program director, engineer, everything. We ran everything to do with the radio station. So during my 4 years there, I did all kinds of things. I was a DJ. I hosted my own radio mystery show. I did news, documentaries. I was the program director my senior year. So did a lot. It was a lot of fun. Learned a lot, too.
Wow. What was your favorite role?
Oh, hard to say. DJing was a lot of fun, but I also really enjoyed doing news because I like being informed. And I like, being able to keep the public and keep people informed as to what was going on. It's just so important to know all these things.
Okay, cool. Alrighty, so the first question I wanted to ask you about was, projects that you're doing. And when I define a project, what I mean is it could be a personal thing, it could be a professional thing. I look at it as something that you're working on that you want to create and that is, currently just really potent for you, something you're really excited about.
I have a lot of irons in the fire right now, and that's probably my biggest weakness is taking on too much and trying to do too much. So a lot of big projects going on in my civilian day job, some which I'm very excited about. I was elected the president of, as you said, of the Transgender American Veterans Association. So we're really trying to do a lot with that organization, trying to refresh our strategic plan and really set ourselves up. We're hoping for big changes to come in the spring. With the new administration. So we want to be poised to be able to do that. We're focused on advocacy for our members, for trans veterans, and providing services for our members and providing the sense of community. But there's really a lot of work that needs to be done to kind of shift from where things were to where things need to be in the future. A little bit of a rebuilding stage as far as the board and revitalizing the membership. So lots and lots of work there, but it's exciting. And I've got some great teammates on the board and some other members in Tava. So that's really exciting. And then personally, since really haven't been able to do a lot of speaking because of COVID and everything. So I've taken advantage of the pause in that to work on my book. So I've been working diligently on my book, and that's really exciting to me.
So tell me about your book and the title and where are you, where are you in the process?
Well, my working title is DIY, as in diversity and inclusion. Why? What's the business case for diversity and inclusion?
Oh, nice.
And I'm describing what I call operational inclusion. And operational inclusion, the nutshell version of it is, if diversity is being invited to the dance and inclusion is being asked to the dance, then operational inclusion is having some of your songs on the playlist. So you're actually having you're included in putting together the dance. You're not just a passive participant or a passive writer or somebody that's just riding along. So it's really about how to leverage the power of diverse and inclusive teams to solve complex problems, to have better predictions, better business results, better relationships among the people, and to help people empower and be their best selves on the job or at wherever they're doing.
Cool. It sounds really needed.
I think so. I think a lot of the diversity programs that are going on right now, and even inclusion, take it pretty far, but they don't take it all the way across the finish line of helping people understand how to put all those parts and pieces together, understanding exactly how our bias is coming into it, and some of the leadership techniques that are required to bring diverse and inclusive groups together. Because with diversity, a lot of times there's going to be friction too, and it takes
absolutely
leadership to be able to bring it. Yeah. The old Storman, Norman, Foreman theory or way of talking about groups and group dynamics.
Right. I mean, I get the sense that having my own corporate experiences that people really like the idea of diversity and inclusion, at least these days. And I think the trick from my perspective is always you have some idea of what it is you want, but it's a long process. You know, it's a long-term process. It's not something that it's not something you accomplish in a quarter. It's something that is a continual work in process. And
exactly.
In my experience, generally, you know, people get kind of bored with it and leadership loses interest because there's some other bright, shiny object. And so, go ahead, please.
It comes with, it takes a pretty hefty investment of time and energy and resources sometimes. It doesn't have that immediate payoff like, buying a new IT system or a marketing campaign much. So it's
right.
So it's really hard to measure the ROI, but it's there and it is measurable. Mm-hmm. And from what I've seen, a lot of programs kind of begin and end in the HR department, and that's
right.
Not going to come. They talk about how to do employee engagement, like it's some separate thing. Okay, we did enough
right.
employee engagement this quarter.
Right.
You know, really, I like the analogy of New York versus Chicago pizza, and obviously, coming from the Chicago area, I'm highly biased.
Right.
But, people talk about toppings on pizza, like it's just like something that's thrown on after the pizza's made as an afterthought. And that's what I think a lot of diversity and inclusion programs are. It's it's a marketing tool, it's a recruitment tool,
right.
It's a check block, but it really needs to be baked in like the ingredients in a Chicago pizza that's layered in there. It's
right.
It's an integral part of the dish.
Mm-hmm.
And it takes, it's day to day, it's everybody, it's all the time. And it's just woven into your business practices.
Yeah, it's just like the piece you said about conflict in particular, it's, like being able to somehow incorporate sometimes some really different perspectives without making people wrong.
And if you think about it, if you're bringing in a lot of different people with different viewpoints and different perspectives and different values and opinions and heuristics and ways of doing things, and everybody gets to say and everybody has an expectation that they're going to be heard and mm-hmm. that they may have a role in things, and you want people that believe in what they're saying, so they're going to advocate strongly for whatever they're thinking, and you're faced with a couple choices. Either you pick one way of doing things, and one person's happy, and everybody else is unhappy, or you compromise, and nobody's exactly happy. Everybody's sort of equally unhappy, but it's not like nobody walks away going, oh, this is so awesome. We compromised, and I got 40% of what I asked for. Yay. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just generally not how it works.
Right.
Or you have to really, really dig deep and find those win-win-win solutions and
totally.
use that diverse, powerful group to come up with a way that really gets at what people are looking for and finds a way to satisfy as many people as possible. But it takes so much extra effort to be able to do that.
No, you're
it's
right.
worth it, but it takes commitment and it takes good facilitation, and it just takes getting people used to thinking of those kinds of solutions.
I can see you actually taking this and potentially teaching it or consulting.
Well, that's my hope. I want to bring it to, you know, a lot of different groups in the business sector, the government sector, nonprofit sector. I see all the time different examples of how, you know, big federal agencies, big for-profit companies, small companies and nonprofits, and some do it well, some do it very poorly. And some
right.
of the groups that you would think would be all about diversity and inclusion and really be getting it right because of who they represent are some of the worst. Really?
No, I absolutely believe you. I've seen many really great ideas fall pretty flat and leave a lot of people feeling very disappointed. So fingers crossed here, you know. Another question that I have for you is, you know, like, what challenges you most?
I'm sorry?
What challenges you most? What are, when you are thinking about, you know, you were specific about one project that you're doing. In general, you know, what kind of challenges do you personally and professionally come up against?
I think for me and probably a lot of other people, it's all the negative talk and the what ifs and, you know, Elizabeth Gilbert talked about how fear, you know, is her constant companion. So she tells fear, okay, you can come along for the ride. You're going to be along for the ride anyway. So get in the car, get in the back seat, you know, you can ride along, you can open the windows and all that stuff, but you're not driving. You're not touching the controls at all, you know? So just knowing that the fear is going to be there because, you know, people, people overemphasize risk and negative, potential negative consequences and undervalue an equal amount of potential positive gain. And there's plenty of studies that back up that that's how most people think.
Right.
And I know, like, from my transition, for instance, that was definitely the case. And I imagine all these horrible worst case scenarios, and thank goodness they didn't come to pass. But I had no idea that my life could be as good as it is right now, you know? Mm. And I think with any project, a lot of us automatically default to, well, it could not work. It might not, you could be embarrassed. You could waste your money. You could fall flat. No one's going to want to meet it. You might not have an audience. You might not.
Absolutely.
Negative, negative, negative.
Right.
And we undervalue the potential of this could be really big. This could be a success. This could be exceed your expectations. It could work out really well. Or the more likely range of it could do okay. You know, it could do pretty well. You know, we might be happy with it, but see some areas for improvement, you know, and we just focus on the negative end of that for so much. And I think this is just kind of a theory of mine, but I wonder if some people are so afraid of things going bad and are like, oh, I know this is going to go bad, that they subconsciously think, well, since it's going to go bad, I might as well just get it over with because I'd rather just experience the bad outcome than anticipate it. So let me sabotage my project.
Oh, interesting.
It automatically, so I get that part over with.
Oh, interesting. Might be.
I don't know. I think
maybe some of it is we do what we're comfortable with. And I know, speaking for myself, I mean, I can really relate to the fear piece. And, oh, wow, it's really good. I think that there's some of it is a healing process. I think some of it is, yeah, maybe, you know, like we, a lot of people perhaps have like a self-image of, you know, I'm just like making this up here, but like, I think a lot of people, most people walk around with kind of a story about this is who I am. I am a I am a person who, will never get what I really want, or I am a person who will never get chosen. You know, and I think, I have a lot of compassion for these stories because I carry them, you carry them, everybody does, right? I think the challenge for all of us is to transcend our story. Or maybe a new story.
Yeah, and that was like, for me, it was such a hard part of transition and such a hard part of facing up to, you know, my gender identity and what I had to do. I'd spent decades crafting this. Decades crafting this identity. Mm-hmm. You know, a cis-hes white male infantry officer. I mean, that comes with so much privilege.
Yes.
And you think, how to give that up?
Yeah.
And not understanding what all the great things that come with that.
Yeah.
But, you know, I wondered sometimes, like, what being trans mean to me if I was trapped on a desert island? And with COVID, it's almost sort of like finding the net out. But I was like, what would that mean? You know, if there's nobody to reflect back to me, because that was such a huge part of it too. As I started exploring my gender identity and having it reflected back to me, I was like, oh, this is right. This feels so right. This is me. This is where I need to be.
Wow.
And not having your identity reflected back to you is like really disorienting, I think.
Yes,
and
I
think, but I think you're really onto something there because we craft these stories but then to let that go. And for me, I mean, I was in my therapist the second time I visit. Well, I visited my first time I ever visited a therapist. She was saying things to me that made it seem like I'd already made up my mind to transition. And I was like, whoa, where's all this coming from? And she was very, very experienced. And the second time I went and said, you might not be able to answer this question, but, you know, based on the things you were saying last time, who do you see sitting in front of you? Somebody that's made up her mind or somebody that's still trying to figure it out? And she said, she paused, kind of weighed what she should say. And she should say anything. And she said, you've already made up your mind.
Oh, wow. That was very.
I just totally broke down. And I spent the rest of the session just sobbing because I couldn't deny that. Couldn't deny it. And it was like, finally, after years and decades of running, the jig was up.
Wow.
It's like, oh crap. Now I have to deal with this.
Oh, wow.
And it was terrifying. My first parachute jump, I literally felt like I had an out of body experience. I was so scared.
Right.
And that was nothing. Going to Afghanistan was nothing compared to that. And, I had to let go of that identity. And I see like military members that separate from the military, and some of them have trouble finding jobs and getting their feet on the ground in civilian life. And what I consistently see there is people that haven't or can't let go of that military identity and embrace the civilian identity. Mm-hmm. You know, because there was somebody in where I work who was a graduate student in international business, getting a master's degree, looking for that kind of senior white collar job. Mm-hmm. But he was still wearing a camouflage ball cap around, carrying a camouflage backpack around, 10 mm-hmm. years after he separated from the military, saying, "Roger this, roger that." Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. "Yes, sir, no, ma'am." All the kind of military stuff.
Right.
And he left the Army as a Sergeant E5. And it's how he was still carrying himself.
Right, right.
All those years later, it's like, you're not there anymore.
Yeah, no, right.
Those days are gone. Embrace the new, you know? Wow. And, but it's, you, it's
but embracing the new, it's hard.
Identity. It's so, it's so hard to let go of because it's such a powerful identity. And
yes, it is. It is.
I get that. I get that totally.
And having that identity is so comforting. You know?
Yeah.
Even though it's kind of a prison, it's still...
Exactly.
Right. I mean,
and then we impose our fear of loss onto that shift. So even if we're afraid of success, we think, "Oh my gosh, my lifestyle will change. My friends might change. My you know, this could change. That people might call me up and try to steal my money or whatever." Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know. So we avoid taking the risk of a big payoff.
Oh, no, I agree with you. I think, you know, like talking about kind of what this golden thread is, you know, I often think of it as sort of, you know, you don't know where it's going to take you. You know,
no.
You see glimpses of it and you don't know, like a friend of mine was talking about hiking and it got really, it was a very foggy day. And she could barely see, you know, maybe a foot or two ahead of her. And, you know, that is, I think that is how it feels. I think you get reinforcement because it feels right. But I also think that just kind of like you also have to be very in touch with your priorities and values to even know that it's right. I think that's what makes it tricky, at least for myself, is that, you know, as human beings, we're so tribal. You know, we're our DNA, like we are wired to be in tribes and to belong to our tribes and to like really deeply belong to communities. And it's helpful to a point, but at the same time, when it is keeping you from, you know, kind of your highest, best purpose in the world, you know, then it becomes a real problem. And it's so funny that here we are, we're so modern with our technologies and we can have community anywhere in the world. And yet, you know, I mean, that for me is like a really challenging thing. You know, are we sort of kind of feeling sort of like, you know, like having to like do something, but like there are old parts of me that really tug at me.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. I feel that a lot.
Yeah.
I feel that a lot.
Yeah.
And, it's interesting what you said because, a lot of times I say, like, with our, you know, some of our mental habits and our biases and things like that, you know, our biases help us process information and they help us so much most of the time.
Exactly.
But there's other times when they work against us. And it's like, to me, the analogy I draw is, you know, as prehistoric people, we ate as much as we possibly could. And we stored calories every time we got a chance, you know, because we never knew what the next thing was. And running around,
I hear you, man.
hunting dinosaurs.
Yes.
And kidding there. And, you know, so it was a very helpful thing to be able to store fat and store calories and all that for later.
Yeah.
But now, you know,
too
much of that, is linked to, you know, heart disease and diabetes and all other health problems.
Yeah.
So, you know, survival tool thing that was really beneficial for us.
Exactly.
Is getting our way.
Right. Yes. I agree completely. So
just like that, fear is a great survival thing.
Yes, it is. Absolutely.
It gets in your way.
Right. I mean, there's not a saber-toothed tiger behind your desk, is there? Nothing you got to worry about there.
But there is a large orange cat that likes to spring out of
it. Okay. Well, that's okay. So you've touched on this a little bit, but I wanted to ask, like, if you wanted to say anything more about, like, what empowers and inspires you so that, like, when you are, you know, going through those hard, you know, those difficult times or those times of self-doubt, you know, what pulls you forward?
That's a great question. So I look back on my life and every good thing that's happened to me, all the best things that have ever happened to me in my life have been accompanied by a big dose of fear, some more than others. You know, and in my military career, I said, you know, if you're not feeling outside your comfort zone a little bit, you're not trying hard enough. Mm-hmm. And in life, I think, if you're not feeling some level of fear or discomfort or being out of your zone there, maybe it's time to push a little harder and kind of experience some of that, because it's normal, it's natural, and it's a sign of growth. You know, it's just like achy muscles come with working out and being healthy. There's always a certain level of soreness that comes with that. And there's some things you just know. And for me, the best things in my life also has been a confluence of the heart and the mind. And when the mind says, you need to do this, this is the right thing. And the heart says, you've got to do this, this is the right thing. And some sense that I really just can't define, like transition, I knew it was just down to a point of either do that or die. And I wanted to live. I just knew that there was something more that I wanted to, I deserved to experience, even if it was just for a little while of my life. And I couldn't not try, you know, at the end of the day.
That's a good way to put it.
And and I just know there's other things that are just too powerful and too important to leave on the table.
What's another example? You know, your transition, like, that was huge, you know? And I'm curious, like, is there, like, another example, because I'm just thinking sometimes it's not obvious, you know, like if it's a smaller issue.
Well, it's like my book, you know, it's like my book. I've experienced places where things are really going well and it feels great and you're accomplishing a lot of things and people are respectful and inclusive. And I've experienced the opposite. And I want to help people experience that good part. And the other thing is, when I share my story and people come up to me and then they start telling me about their stories, what they've struggled with.
Yeah.
And it's so empowering and we both learn so much. And I just want to help encourage anybody else that's saying, can I do this? Can I, you know, can I be my self, you know?
So there's like what I'm hearing is there's a big piece of you that really wants to pay it forward.
Yeah. And, you know, so many people shared their stories with me when I was really needed help, and they gave me encouragement and empowerment. And I just feel I've got to pay that back. I've got to put something back like that, because it's so awesome. It's so awesome just to be free and be and just not have that guilt and shame anymore. And there's so many people that are living in that prison that, and they don't have to. And I want to help them get out. And it's just my life's mission. I just know that that's what it is. And so it just pulls me along. It pulls me along to write my book because that's part of it. It pulls me along to share my story because that's a big part of it. And just encourage other people to just knock down those prisons and be free.
So it sounds like actually the next question I was going to ask you, and I feel like you answered it very eloquently, was what kind of a legacy do you want to leave? And I heard from you, you know, you want to be a force for inspiration, for empowerment, and for liberation.
Exactly. You know, nobody should have to hide who they are. You know, we're all made the way we are, you know, if you're religious or not. But we're all made the way we are for some reason. I don't believe it's just random chance, you know. And there's something we're supposed to get out of this time on our earth. You know, this time on the earth.
I agree. And, absolutely.
And it's there and you can do it. You can do it.
Well, you've done it, you know, and you're doing it.
I just want people to know that and believe it.
Yeah. No, I think that's like incredible.
And I want people to know that they're not alone. You know, we're all dealing with this stuff.
Help each other out. That's really, I think, especially these days, that's very, certainly very potent for me.
Yeah, look at all the people that have knocked down walls of shame and guilt, and like Betty Ford, you know, disclosing her alcoholism, or Michelle Obama recently talking about her depression, and and other people, you know, people in the LGBT community that have that came out like Stonewall and just said, you know what? No, we're not, there's nothing wrong with who we are. We're not born evil people. And and other people stand up for their dignity, you know, and no one should have to hide who they are or pretend, you know, there's no reason for it. And it's toxic. You know, the only people that hide what they're doing are people that are doing something wrong. And, you know, if you're born a certain way, that's just who you are. It's not good or bad. It's just who you are. And no one should have to hide that.
Well, may it be so. The more the better.
It's our job to make it so.
Right. That's, yes. Lead through example, right?
Exactly.
So, I guess... some of this interview was designed when I was speaking with somebody who was an artist or a maker, specifically because that particular path can be a rather challenging one. not to say that your path is like any less challenging or anything like it. It just happens that your particular occupation isn't in that area. So, the way I'm going to ask it is, you know, what advice would you give somebody? And I don't know if that, you know, it would be specific to somebody who is in a position where they're thinking about transitioning gender, or there are other challenges that you would want to inspire somebody to deal with. What is one or two pieces of advice that you would offer? That, you know, one of those things where I wish I knew then what I know now.
I think, you know, you just have to be, you have to be your authentic self. You have to be you, whoever that is. You know, and I'm sure any artist would agree with that, that that only they can do their art. Nobody else can do their art. Mm-hmm. And the minute an artist tries to start doing somebody else's art, they fail.
Yep.
The minute a leader tries to imitate some other leader, they fail. The minute a teacher tries to teach in a way that's not authentic to themselves, they fail. You know, same with the writer, whether you're writing nonfiction or fiction. Mm-hmm. And I learned that, you know, not only through my transition, I learned it through leadership, just watching good leaders and not so good mm-hmm. leaders, and my own personal experiences leading groups. And I learned it in my speaking. I had an experience where I spoke at a federal agency, and I held back a little bit, and they asked me to talk mm-hmm. about a couple different topics. So I included those into my talk, and I tried to do a couple different things with it other than just be me and my authentic mm-hmm. self. Mm-hmm. And it went well, and I got a good reception, but my mentor was there, and she'd seen me give really authentic talks, and she said that you fell flat today. Mm-hmm. That wasn't you. Mm-hmm. Because I wasn't just trusting my own strength, my own authenticity, meeting with all of that, and I was trying to shape and mold and create it into something else. Mm-hmm. You know, and her comment was, there wasn't enough of you in that.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm. yeah, and that's what people want.
Whether you're an accountant or a car mechanic or a pilot or a symphony conductor, it's got to be you.
Mm-hmm. Can I ask you, so I have like sort of a follow-up question. So sure. How do you, you know, to me, you know, maybe the metaphor for sailing might be good here. How do you know whether you're being authentic or not authentic?
Oh, wow. That's a really good question.
Yeah, like, you know,
Is it scary?
Yeah. Oh, I like
me,
that.
When I speak, do I feel like extremely vulnerable yet extremely powerful at the same time?
Oh, okay. That's good. I like that. That's good.
You know,
mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. am I feeling like strong emotions?
Mm. Yeah.
So
there's like a little bit of rawness there, it sounds like.
Yeah, and it's this I'm struggling for words right now. It's a paradox of strength and vulnerability.
Yeah.
Right together.
Yeah.
Just like, you know, Brené Brown kind of talks about that too.
Mm-hmm.
But it's really,
I think you're doing a really, actually, I think you're doing a great job of articulating it. I think for me, Anne, it's often that our heart knows, even if our head can't quite articulate
exactly.
it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So there's like definitely a piece of intuitive knowing.
It's kind of like being in love and you can't describe mm-hmm. it. You can't quantify it. You can't put your finger on it. There's many, many different aspects of it. Mm-hmm. But, you know, there's probably a gray area where you're not sure, but there's some areas where you know definitely not, and mm-hmm. some areas where you know you mm-hmm. definitely are.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the same with being authentic.
Yeah,
there may be some ambiguous zone in there, but when you're
mm-hmm.
right fully in the authentic area, there's all kinds of stuff going on, and it feels right. It just feels right.
Yeah.
It's scary. And when the little voice pops up and says, are you sure you should be doing this? Are you sure you should be doing this?
Yeah.
The other part of you. And that's what I experienced in my first parachute jump. I had this out of body experience, and I was so scared. My legs were shaking, and
the other
jumpers had gotten out. And
I swear, Anne, I would have
peed
in my pants.
I don't know. they had two they call them chocks, so groups of jumpers. We had made two passes, so I'd watched two groups go out, and then it was me and somebody else behind me. So I was in the door, and I was like, oh, no, oh, no. There's nobody in front in the door now. This is it.
Right.
And my mind sort of felt like it separated out. Mm. And part of me, like my rational part, floated up above my body and said, oh, well, this is how it all ends. You know, it's going to be – it was interesting, okay. You know, while it lasted. And then some other part of my mind said, all right, I'm just going to get a good exit. I'm going to jump. It's mm-hmm. like, okay, terrified part of my brain, you sit over there and freak out in the corner. That's fine. I'm going to just concentrate on getting a good exit. And then that part of myself told my body, okay, body, you've done this a lot of times in training. Mm-hmm. Just go for muscle memory. Take mm-hmm. it from there.
Can I make an observation?
It was probably my most technically proficient jump because I was too panicked to do anything wrong.
Hmm. What I was going
to say. But it's like the mind sort of separates out and these different parts you're mm-hmm. talking to you. And it's like, that's partially what being authentic feels like to me.
What came to mind as you were speaking was, you also reframed the objective, right? So like the way you put it was, I'm going to do a really good exit.
Yeah.
And did that make it easier?
Probably. It gave me one thing to sort of just focus on, I guess. Mm-hmm. But like I said, it was so scary that I just couldn't do anything wrong. Then when, you know, I remember everything. I was like so vivid. And then the parachute opened up and I looked at it, you know, checked it out. It was all okay. And then I looked around and I was like, oh, this is so cool. Look. Mm. And then I'm like, oh, maybe I can see my house from here. Wow. It's like, oh, the ground's coming. I better get ready.
That's really cool.
But, you know, when I'm really feeling authentic, I really feel vulnerable, strong, excited, and just like anxious. And I trust mm-hmm. there's this feeling of like, I know what I'm doing. Mm-hmm. And that voice inside of me that's trying to second guess me gets overruled. Mm-hmm. And I feel this power of like, let's see where this goes, you know? Mm. This is so cool. Let's see if I can see my house. Let's see where this goes. I want to see what's next.
Cool. That's really cool. Yeah. Yeah. I hear you. I can relate. I just think sometimes of like trying to do like a new painting technique or something like that. And I feel very intimidated and just do it and find myself really enjoying it after a while. But there's definitely that fear and that desire not to like mess up.
Yeah. And I imagine I imagine if you're not feeling authentic about it, you lose interest and you stop.
Mm-hmm.
If it's not your art.
Mm-hmm. You're right. That's very true. Wow. So thank you so much. Gosh, you shared a lot of really, just made me think a lot, touched my heart a lot. For people who would like to learn more about you, where do they go?
Well, I'm glad you asked. They can go to my webpage at Ann Murdock altogether, just Ann Murdock, MURDOCH, .com. Sorry, spaced out on the .com. So it's ANNMURDOCH.com, AnnMurdock.com, or they can visit my YouTube channel, which they can also link to from my webpage.
Cool. I will. As I said, I will, when I put the recording up, that will be on my website, Pocket of Serenity, and I will include your website URL, the link, and also the link for your YouTube channel.
Awesome. Thank you.
So people can experience more of you.